This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
My name is Antoine Haywood. I'm a second year PhD student at the Annenberg School for Communication. It's a pleasure, and I'm just so delighted to sit here with a good friend and inspirational force in the world of media and activism, Dede Halleck, and just to talk about, we're going to talk about a lot of things. And I mean, the biggest thing that, the frame of this conversation is discussing the continued relevance of community media in a digital age. I know many times, during when I was working as a practitioner at PhillyCam, and actually just, this summer as I was doing my internship in D.C., you always get this question of why do we need community media, specifically why do we need public access television when people can go do this stuff on YouTube or when people can go to the digital platform? Or, is community, are they able to keep up? Are they using digital tools? Do they have the capacity to do that? Do they have the capacity to be journalists and storytellers, and what all that means? So we'll talk about all of that. Dede has been fighting for free and independent television for more than 50 years, giving people a voice in communities that often do not have media space. So Dede is a media activist and maker, one of the founders of Paper Tiger Television and Deep Dish Satellite Network, and also has been a professor in the Department of Communication at the University of California, San Diego. The first film was Children Make Movies, 1961, which I had a chance to, you came and screened that in Scribe. Was it Philly? You saw that a couple years ago?
A while ago.
Yeah, we had a chance to see that. That was my introduction to that valuable piece of work. So this was a film project. It was about filmmaking project at Lillian Ward Settlement in Lower Manhattan. Dede has led countless media workshops with elementary school children, reform school youth, migrant farm workers, many marginalized people, helping them give them a voice. She also has co-directed Child Made Film Symposium, which was a 15-year assessment of media by youth throughout the world, and has done a retrospective of her. There's been a retrospective of her work done, screened at the Documentary Festival of Brazil in Rio de Janeiro and Sao Paulo, and this was in 1994. She served as a delegate to the International Symposium of New Technologies and Democratization of Communications in New Delhi, and as a board member of Videsmut, the International Communication Video Association. So Dede is truly a pioneer in video, and her contributions are very, very, very important to the field and independent media. And I say thank you too personally, because your work, if it wasn't for your work and all those things that you, George, Dirk, and I mean, you can go down the line. I feel like I wouldn't be, you blazed a path even for me to be here today. So aww. I really thank you for that, Dede. I thank you for that. We met in, was it 2007? The ACM conference in Minneapolis. And, I was bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, new to doing public access. And I was like, I want to make change. And then Dede, of course, comes, because Dede always has, I'm surprised you don't have a camera right now. But Dede always has a camera. Right. We're in a digital
Everyone
age.
Does now.
So Dede comes up, and she's like, I want to get an interview with you. And she just, did the camera. And I was like, okay. I'm like, who is this lady? Like, talk to me. Why does she want to talk to me? But I knew Dede was important, just like George, because people were like, oh, there's George. So I'm very grateful again. Yeah, we had that moment to meet, and have been in just, our paths have been aligned throughout, ever since the beginning of my career in doing community media 15 years ago. And I do want to also mention, and then we'll transition here into our conversation as I set this up. You worked alongside with George Stoney in terms of advocating for public access in New York. Correct, for MNN, back in the 90s. Yeah, and served on the board. Having said that, I would like to take an opportunity to start our conversation with just this, to frame it about when we say community media, and community media means so many things. And of course, Didi, I have to hold this up. Victor Picard, I have to do this in the spirit of Victor because Victor always likes to bring books to class, and I do too. This is Didi's book, Handheld Visions, on, and then, oh, and in Clemencia. who is, I hope she can join us today. I haven't heard from recently, but really gives a good and there's other lots of other literature about just what community media is and the many forms in which it can be practiced. And I also like to refer to it, you know, as democratic media making or communal media making, participatory media making. So having said that, Didi, let's start. Can you give just from your experience, what are some of the forms of community media that that exist and continue to exist, and what are things that like that make them that makes it unique, you know, that makes it, what are like some are the essential qualities that you've found through all of your work that are inherent and important for us to think about when it comes to community media?
Well, you reminded me of one that. When we were trying to get, there was a channel in New York City for public access, but there was no center, no place where people could come together, and there was a commercial studio where we actually had to rent it, and that's why the early Paper Tiger shows we would put the budget, because everybody had to dig into their pockets and take out their change, and that's how we paid the studio, because there wasn't a public access, there wasn't the infrastructure. And so we fought for that. And what we called it was, New York Citizens Committee for Responsible Media. I thought that was an interesting, I think we probably spent two nights talking about what the title of our group should be, but that was I think George's suggestion that we call it responsible. So, if we think, one of the reasons I brought Clemencia's book was that she talks a lot about what phrase to use, and she talks about citizens media, participatory media, independent media, alternative media, community media, non-commercial media, maybe they're all a little bit different, but they all have aspects of what we mean when we do what we do, you know. I think when I first met you, you were at Atlanta.
Yeah, I was working in Atlanta.
Atlanta. And yeah. There's also avant-garde. A lot of people think, well, community media is what's going to be in the future. Like it's more, it can be more experimental and kind of avant-garde. So it's a lot of different things. And actually, I was talking with somebody at Columbia. Do you know that the word oral history comes from Columbia University, from Teachers College? And they now have a collection of what they called, they decided to call it time-based media. So that's a whole other description. But looking back, and I think one of the amazing things that the work of community media makers has done, we don't even think of this usually when we're doing it, is we're making history and we're preserving not just the people and the ideas, but also the whole way of doing it, the culture, the kind of the aesthetics of it, so that when people look back in the early 70s, at like some of the earliest public access was in Reading, Pennsylvania, like you're seeing, you're. It's so much more authentic than what was going on NBC, CBS, there was not even any CNN at that time when it first started. But maybe authenticity. Maybe that's a.
What were some things, that qualities that made it authentic? That.
Well, it's not corporate. It's not made to sell something. It's media that is made to enable people to express themselves, to voice their passions, their concerns, their craziness sometimes. Anybody who's been in public access mm-hmm. knows that. but it's not prepackaged. It's sort of like a home cooked meal. Mm-hmm. It's so different from what you get from even Fresh Direct or whatever. It's like what comes from the handprint, from a handmade mug from when your daughter starts doing ceramics, you will see that will be your favorite coffee cup. Yeah. I guarantee you.
Oh yeah, I already know. Yeah.
And that, why do you want that one as opposed to one that's made in China in a factory with a zillion other cups just like it? Mm-hmm. It bears the print of your daughter or your friend or whoever. And the same thing for public access. It's who we are somehow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm already starting to like hoard her artwork, and she just, "Daddy, yes. I'm coming." I'm like, "Yeah, keep that." You know. but that's interesting that you point that out, because actually, as in preparation of our conversation today, I was just thinking the exact same thing about, like, you know, this uniqueness. And when I travel, when I can, I like to go find, that's one of the first things I do when I get to wherever I'm going, when I get to a TV, is to like, what are they doing here? Mm. And it's like, to me, it's like going someplace and not going to McDonald's or Burger King, but it's like, I want to get what everybody else eats here. Like, what's the authentic, what's the thing, you know, that really makes this community, it's from the people, you know? So that's how I thought of it as well. Yeah, yeah. What inspired you to become involved in doing this authentic form of documenting history, educating people, liberating people through this communal process? What was it that really?
Well, when I was a teenager in Chattanooga, Tennessee, I wanted I wanted to get some cash to have in my pocket, and I looked around for jobs, and I saw there was a film studio called Continental Productions. And when I was 13, I started working there as an animator, actually. And they were making pork sausage commercials, Parks pork sausage commercials. And there was the animator, actually was named Hal Walker, and he was the founder of Felix the Cat, actually. What was he doing in Chattanooga? Well, he was a union organizer working for Disney, and who had then worked for Disney after he did Felix the Cat. And he's in the animation books, actually. And I didn't know at that time who he was, but he would do the drawings, and I would copy them onto acetate. He would do drawings on paper, and he would do, like, you know how animation works, your hand is up here and then it goes down here, and you have to do 14 different drawings to have it go down. Mm-hmm. So I started out as an in-betweener. He would do the top and the bottom, and then I graduated to be an in-betweener, because he finally trusted me to even do the in-betweener. And I was like, I was thinking it was like, animation is so, at that time, you work on a cell that has like sprockets, and you don't, there's no art to it. It's, I mean, there is art, obviously, because there's a lot of great animators, but there was something confined about it. And and also, it was very hard for people to do. And I felt like media early on, I said, well, why can't we just draw? Why do we have to work in this very rigid format? And
was it mechanical? It was more
Well, it's a mechanical thing to actually take, to be able to make something that looks free and easy. Hmm. And you have to be very precise and have be able to make the in-betweens look easy, look the same. And I rebelled against that kind of stricture, I guess. And then I saw Norman McLaren, who was a great Canadian animator. And I saw his films through the library, and the public library in Chattanooga would have film screenings of experimental films. Some of the that's one of the great traditions of libraries. A lot of them had really good, a wide variety of art films and documentaries. I was very curious about film, and so I would go to screenings. And and I became really, I found that you could actually, one of Norman McLaren's films is you draw on the films. Mm. It's making films without a camera. Mm-hmm. And to me that was liberating. And so I worked, when I quit school, I only went to college for 2 years, and then I went to New York City. I got married, and I worked as a kind of after school. And I thought, wow, you know, I showed the kids films. That was one of my jobs, was on Friday nights we would show films, and to kids, or Friday afternoons. And so I would check out films for myself, which were these experimental films, and films for the kids. And the kids wanted to see the experimental films. They didn't care about all these children's films. And so when they saw the Norman McLaren actually drawing on film, they said, I want to do that. So I brought in some leader, just blank film, and they drew on the film. And so they made their own. And actually, the excitement and the passion of the kids, really, I said, wow, everyone should be able to make films. And why does it have to be just these companies like I had worked in Tennessee? Like, and so that was my, I was only like, when I moved to New York, I was like 18. Mm-hmm. And I've been trying to help people make films ever since.
So that was your moment. That was that transformative moment.
Yeah.
Mine was similar, where I was at a rec center in Atlanta, and I was dead set to go to New York, and I had this moment of where it just was super clear of like, you know, putting, I had these adult students that came into the media lab that I was operating, and they were like, we want to make, you know, we want to do slideshows, and I want to scan my yearbook photos. And it was just like the most important thing for them to do at that moment. Mm-hmm. And is to get that education. And I was like, this is what it's about in terms of making it accessible. And I think in the collaboration, right, to work in working with people, it's not so much about directing, right? It's more so about togetherness, right? And caring. It's a caring. We care together through this process, would you say? doing communal media making work.
Yeah, you know, I was after that. I worked at a reform school. It was called Reform, And now it would be like a juvenile prison. I mean, it's for those. I always felt it was like a gulag. It was like I really felt very oppressed there, and felt that the kids were very oppressed. But we did. I got a grant for doing filmmaking, and it was part of what the school, this institution, was up in the Catskills, actually, and they had in the mornings there was education, and in the afternoons there was vocational, and I was part of vocational, although I only taught half time there, and so I only taught in the afternoons, and and they. My purpose was almost always to get the kids away from that place. And so when we would film, they filmed outside. They filmed in the town near there. And I could get the state car, and there was an insignia on the state car, and. One time we're driving, we're going off grounds, and the guys say, Aditi, stop right now. And I said, what? He said, well, you'll see. And they had made a sign for the car, and it said Otisville Film Club. And they put it over the state insignia with gaffer tape, and they taped that on. So here we were, and we had to remember when we came back to take it off. But I said, that really is what it is, and there's Clemente.
Yeah, there she is.
It really was a club, mm-hmm. and I felt that they worked together. It was, I never gave lectures or anything. It was like an open studio where people came in, and they would, they could either listen to music. There was a record player, 33 mm-hmm. and 45s,
yeah.
And there was a TV. They could watch TV if they wanted to, whatever channel they wanted. And then there was filmmaking, and they could read books. I had a lot of books there, like biographies of artists. One guy was reading, I have a picture of him reading a book about Rembrandt. A kid from the Bronx.
Yeah, what kind of changes did you observe, like, with going through that entire process of, and not just actually the media-making process, but the whole entire experience?
Well, I've been trying to get a hold of some of those guys that I worked with. I worked there for 4 years, mm-hmm. Now this was in from like 68 to 72. They're like in their late 60s now.
Yeah, yeah.
So some of them probably aren't around. I mean, the recidivism rate from these schools was very high, so they would go back. I did run into one at when I was visiting a prison years later, and he was still there, and he said, oh, that was the best time of my life, you know. So it was, I don't think you can change people's lives, but it was opening something and making them more curious. Maybe mm-hmm. they would do more reading, maybe. I don't think, you know, what, maybe some of them might have gotten a job working on mm-hmm. a film set, or, but yeah. It wasn't like, you can't have a miracle change in people's lives when, you know, that's why I think public access is so important, because if it sets up a kind of a base, and have a space where people know about it and can build up a kind of sustained interest. And I think these kids were only at Otisville for like maximum 18 weeks. Mm-hmm. No, 18 months. 18 months, yeah. So it's not like you can do that much in 18 months, but I hope to think. I mean, one of my students who wasn't one of the guys at Otisville, but who I met through the guys because they wanted to go find girls in Middletown, and Floribel Hunter, who is going to be tonight at the Community Media Center. She made a film called Hey There, Lonely Girl. Mm-hmm. And she said it. You should ask her how it changed her life, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, or the other way I guess I should have put it is the effects, you know, in terms of just how, yeah, just that experience, like what that experience meant, you know, if you could tell.
Well, I think probably the most important thing in terms of the institution was that the films became very popular around the town. People would like I took kids to go to the Kiwanis Club. They presented films at the Kiwanis Club. They went to the churches. They went to libraries. I couldn't even remember all the ones that I ran across. I'm going through all my papers now, and there was this list of all the places at different conferences, and I always took the guys who made the films there. And this was 16 millimeter. It wasn't video. Mm-hmm. It wasn't easy. It was hard. And they felt very accomplished mm-hmm. when they finished.
Yeah. So you did shoot, make sure your exposure, your light was all right. Then you had to send it off, get it processed, and hope you had something. And
the real problem was getting the right songs.
Yeah.
Onto the right scenes, so they would bring in their 45s. The films have really great music.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've seen
it. Yeah, I remember seeing it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you bought them.
Get on the Good Foot.
Yeah. James Brown. Let's transition and talk about, you actually mentioned, building. And I want to talk about building trust and doing this work and truth-telling through the process of doing community media work or media engagement work. What has that looked like in your experience in terms of how have people been able to, and then you can also talk about maybe, how this ties into your work with Deep Dish, Paper Tiger, or the indie media movement. How do these communal media-making process, are people able to build trust and tell truths?
Well, Paper Tiger started as a kind of critique of the mainstream media, and I think that's one of the functions of public access is to actually to really look hard at what's going on with the mainstream. I mean, we started out with the New York Times, which is, people said, oh, well, what's wrong with the New York Times? I depend on it, But we said, well, there are certain issues about the New York Times that if you look at who's on the board of directors, Herb Schiller was a communication scholar who I had read his material, and I was teaching at Hunter College and in New York City, part of CUNY, and Herb came as a guest lecturer, and our classrooms were near each other, and I kept hearing all this laughter, and I thought, what? Afterwards, I said, Herb, what were you doing? He said, oh, I was just reading the New York Times. And I think, before John Oliver and before, John Stewart, Herb Schiller had this sardonic kind of humor that with which to look at mainstream media. I think you have to look at it with humor, but also great insight. And I think that is an important part of doing anything in media is you have to be able to process it.
And so, yeah, so Herb, was Herb on the show and read the Times?
So I thought he could just do one show. And he said, well, you need six shows to do. So we did six shows, and we got a group of people together to do it. And then it seemed like a good format to have. A lot of problems with public access is that people have their image of what media is so fixated on mainstream media. So when they'll do a public access show and it doesn't look like CBS or NBC, they feel disappointed. Or if they, even like if they ask their friends to watch it and they forget to watch it, and then they'll do one show. You can't do that. So we decided to do a series, and we did six programs, and we also leafleted. We leafleted the New York Times building because we felt that the most important audience were people who actually, the printers who worked at the Times, and also the editors and the writers. So if you go at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the editors are going home and the printers are coming in. I mean, mm-hmm. there was a particular time of day where we could get both the blue collar mm-hmm. workers and the people with cooler blazers or whatever. But the idea was that we had. It seemed like a format. A lot of people start to do public access, and if you have someone who can talk and who feels comfortable, then you can work with them. It's more like it's television is something really different than making a film, and there's the liveness of it. We were doing live programming. I'm going to do a live programming on Friday.
Yeah, Friday at yes. Philly Cam. Yeah, yes. 7 o'clock. Yeah.
Yes. So, and I think I love doing live programming, and we would just work together to try to improvise it and really push the format. I mean, I think people are so imbued with like what television should look like, and it doesn't have to be like that. We can make it. We could use hand painted sets. We use instead of like actually it was a necessity because we couldn't afford the Chiron, which is how people did the titles. So we had people hand paint titles. And it was cheaper.
Yeah.
Because that was when we were working in the commercial in the studio. We had to pay for it. And every camera was $16, and a color camera was $35, and so it all added up. And if you use Chiron, it's a different. And actually, we didn't even have headphones with a speaker. So we had to leave the cues on set. So we were really, but it actually became a new kind of look on TV. And so we were trying to push the aesthetics at the same time.
Yeah. I guess then that's what I was.
And the public access community was very open to that because, they could show their constituents, like, look, it doesn't, you know, relax, you know, there's the public access look, you know, and you don't always have to have a plant and a
right, the ficus, you know, or the ferns, Zach Galifianakis has it.
So we were trying to push what public access could do.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, but there's still that long-standing critique of, it looks like public access, or it looks like, you know, there's this normative critique of community media broad, like even radio or zine, it's like who wants to watch that? Who wants to consume that? Because if it's not polished, can we trust that type? Because of who are these people? They aren't experts. They're just people on the street. What do you say to those notions?
Well, I think you have to, somehow you have to be providing them with authentic information and also build a kind of trust, as you said. I thought that was a good point. It's like that's an important aspect.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask just one more question, and we're going to open it up. I'm just keeping sense of time. So, because this is, I want to hear, we have like a lot of expertise,
yes.
A lot of expertise in the room. And I'm sure people have some questions they want to share with you and ask. In terms of, I want to focus on just this, the relevance of community media, and just hear your thoughts on, you know, in a digital age where people have, where they can create, they can stream from this phone, where people can, I took a video of Ava at the turntables last night, you know, we were picking out records and stuff, you know, and I didn't upload it, but it's like I can make that a quote-unquote show on YouTube. In addition to the critique about, like, of the access of this amateurish or unpolished look, there's also I've heard this so many times in doing policy work locally and even nationally of just why do we need community media spaces when people can go around and they can make media on their own? You know, why do we need a Philly Cam? You know, why do we need Scribe? Why do we, what's the value? What's the importance of G-Town Radio? Why do we need all of these things still in 2019 when you can make a podcast in your living room? We were talking earlier, you know, so why do I need to go down to WPEB?
One of the most popular things at Brooklyn Public Access is the podcast show. Mm-hmm. So people need those lessons. They want to get more, they want to feel comfortable with it, and they want to exchange with other people to hear how it's a process of learning. And I think that even though you have your handy telephone with you all the time, there are some tricks you could learn to edit it and to actually. That was interesting what you said about the people wanted their high school yearbooks.
Yeah.
I mean,
Benny, he came in. I'll never forget him. You know, Mr. Benny came in, and I can't even describe, like, the look on his face when I told him, yes, you can scan this yearbook photo and put it together and make a slideshow with the music from 1968 or whatever it was. Yeah. And he had to walk out the room, collect himself, and come back in. And he's like, I can do this. But, yeah, it's
you know, the NBC or CBS is not going to be doing that.
No.
Or even like Hulu or Netflix or whatever. So how can we preserve? I mean, to me, public access is such an interesting experiment in actually taxing corporations in a way that enables them to support community activity. And what the cable companies right now are racing to try to eliminate that, and we have to really.
They've been pushing on that though for 30 years, ever since the beginning, right?
Right, but now they have this ammunition that, like, forget it, you have your cell phone, you have your podcast or whatever. Why do you need public access? And we want to be trained in those areas, and we want to work with other people. And I think we have to really stress that it's not enough to be alone in your basement. Or I think the big corporations love the image of the lone guitar player in his basement. What was his name?
Oh, Wayne and Garth.
Wayne's World. It's like that's that they kept saying. Well, it's like public access is like Wayne's World. No, public access is like amazing in terms of the different organizations need to be able to work with their constituents, to speak to their constituents, and the different. One of my favorite shows was Elliot Margulies. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember him. Yeah. He was doing public access in Palo Alto, and he used to have the people who did music lessons, because they didn't have a space. They had to pay, the music teachers had to rent a space, and they didn't have the funds for that. So he offered his studio if they would let them also videotape him. So, and they were thrilled to be videotaped. So he always had like little like three-year-olds doing their up the hill we go. And it's I remember watching an entire show of it, and it was so fresh. So I mean, the parents were able to see their kids, but also it was sharing these kids with the community in a really very, very straightforward, non-exploitative way. It wasn't like the Miss America, mm-hmm. Junior America, or whatever they do. And I thought, this is some of the best kids programming ever. It's like there are ways that, and it also made the parents appreciate and support the public access.
Yeah. Yeah, I was talking to a group of students just earlier or last week about just community media, and then specifically public access. And one of the students, like, very succinctly put it, I was asking them about the distinction between like this form, this type of engagement, and like public television. And he was just saying, he's like, this is more humane, you know. He's like, there's like humanity here, and not saying that there's not humanity there, but it's like it's in a very unique way of it's really about people coming together and just being together, one another. Yeah. That being said, being together, we are here together, and I want to shift and open it up so to allow you all to ask any questions.
Or make a comment.
And make any comments. That too. I know there's a lot of people who like to share thoughts in the room. And there's a. There will be passing a mic around. Yeah. Does anyone? I do have more questions. So, but I just want to. Yeah.
Thanks, Aaron.
I think so.
Doing it? Okay. Thanks so much for sharing your thoughts and for moderating the conversation, Antoine. I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit more about, like, what do you hope happens for community media in the next, I don't know, generation?
Huh. Well, I see a lot of two of my grandchildren, and they all of a sudden have become very involved with GarageBand. Mm-hmm. And there's something so seductive about these screens, and I worry about that, because I think we don't want to become too they should go outside and play, actually. Mm-hmm. I think it's an issue about making about how as a grandparent I become this kind of ogre who takes their iPad away if they spend 2 hours on GarageBand, you know. What do you think? I mean, I feel like on one hand, it struck me about GarageBand is they don't even need other people. They can make like 5 different voices and mix it all together.
Yeah, beats, bring in instruments.
And why be in a band, you know? And I originally thought, oh, GarageBand is so creative for them. And then I thought, no, what we really need is to get the kids to get to practice their instruments and play with other people rather than depend on this machine to do it.
As a musician, I totally argue against that. You know, I mean, I love GarageBand, and I encourage, when I've worked with youth doing youth media work, I definitely was like, yeah, get up, make a beat, because that's the connecting point for some kids. It's like, oh, I can make a beat. They're not really into like doing the camera just yet or being on camera, but they want to. But there's something unique, and this ties to like my feelings about community media is this, again, it's the in-person, it's the contact. And so when you jam together, you go places that you can't go. You can only go because we're vibing off of each other as human beings. And you go to this place where it's like, I couldn't, because when you're on that machine, it's just you, right? And then you're interacting with the machine or you're whatever pre-programmed in. But when my buddy Ant plugs up and starts doing, that comes from Ant. Right. Nobody else can replicate that, and it's this like cross-fertilization that happens. It's another like little new term that that Sarah Zia, I was talking to her earlier this week, and she was talking about, it's in spaces like Philly Cam and Scribe, it's like there is this constant cross-fertilization that happens.
We have a lot of work to do.
We do. and on that note, one of the quotes from your book that I actually put up on the website is you said, it's one thing to critique mass media and rail against their abuses. It's quite another to create valuable alternatives. And that speaks to the work that we have to do all together. So having said that, please join me in thanking Dee Dee